Welcome. If you lose connection at any time, reconnect by clicking the link in your email invite. Committee members, please activate your video and keep it on for the duration of the meeting. Use the raise hand feature if you wish to speak, ask questions, or request a roll call vote. City staff, please activate your video when you are speaking. Use the raise hand feature when you are asked a question. And for members of the public, the name you entered in Zoom must match the name you entered in registration. You will remain muted until called upon by the chair. Please do not use your video. Chair, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Lisa. At this time, could you do a call, the roll call of commissioners, please?
Yes. Commissioner Claude Gilmore.
Present.
Gilmore present. Commissioner Dwayne Gray.
Present.
Gray present. Commissioner Greg Reed. Commissioner Greg Reed.
Present.
Reed present. Commissioner Madeline O'Connor.
Present.
O'Connor present. Commissioner Mary Strickland.
Present.
Strickland present. Alder Isidore Knox.
Present.
Knox present. And Alder Tag Evers.
Here.
Evers present. Chair, a quorum is present.
Oh, thank you very much. At this time, I'd like a motion and a second to approve the minutes from our August 8th meeting.
I so move.
I second.
Been moved and seconded that minutes from the August 8th meeting be approved. We'll consider this a unanimous vote unless there are any objections. Hearing none, motion approved. Are there any public comments?
There are no registrants for tonight's meeting.
Okay, thank you. Are there any communications?
Just a few. Wanted to highlight that yesterday at the Triangle, we hosted a resident picnic, which was well attended. So I wanted to thank staff for their efforts in that and recognize the residents for coming out. We had a beautiful night. Also, here at the Triangle, I just gave a Lauren and I gave a site tour to the Wisconsin chapter of the American Planning Association, who's in Madison this week for a conference. A well-attended tour here from professional planners from around the state. And then I wanted to mention next, nope, I'm sorry, Monday the 23rd, we will have our second public meeting for Park Badger. I'm sorry, second round of public meetings for Park Badger. The first meeting on Monday the 23rd will be a Zoom meeting at noon. And the second meeting will be in person at Catholic Multicultural Center at 6 p.m. So again, that's a similar structure to what we did at our last round of meetings, where we had the noon virtual meeting and then an in-person evening meeting. That's all I have for communications.
That's good. If you and those that that's for the people obviously to participate, would that link be sent out to board members if we wanted to join in?
We'd be happy to share the link. Just keep in mind, though, if we do have a quorum, we have to be careful for any concerns about having a quorum of the board.
Correct. Understood.
Okay.
Commissioner Gray, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman. Hey, I just wanted to reiterate, I was at the picnic the CDA hosted yesterday, and just want to commend them on their efforts to really come out and organize this picnic in a way and be so willing and open to, answering questions from residents and certainly providing a nourishment as well. And so I just felt that that was certainly something that was very heartfelt, and appreciate the work that you all did to certainly make that possible. Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Is there any other communication, Larry?
No, that's it.
All right, thank you. Are there any disclosures or recusals? Hearing none. We have one item on the consent agenda related to a Ross grant that I would like a motion and a second for approval.
Dwayne, Commissioner Gray, I make a motion that we move this forward.
It's been moved and seconded that resolution number 4622 be approved, and we'll consider this a unanimous vote unless there are any objections. Hearing none, motion approved. First item on discussion is the report of the CDA Finance Subcommittee, and I'll turn it over to Commissioner Strickland.
Okay, can everybody hear me? Okay, so Ann went over at our finance committee meeting, went over the second quarter financials, and also we went over the 2023 audit. And let me just say, the second quarter financials were pretty much in line, meeting kind of the expectations that we've had. We've had some issues with higher vacancies, which decreased the revenues. But as Ann said, it gave us an opportunity to rehab some units. But otherwise, the second quarter financials were fine. I want to kind of focus on the audit. Once again, the CDA had a clean audit, which is great. And thanks to the staff for that. That means that the financial statements reflect the CDA operations. And as we all know, it's a large and complex organization. So there's a lot of work that goes into this audit. And we have sub audits of by other CPA firms of parts of the CDA. But anyway, the financial statement highlights, and I think you guys, I think the CDA commissioners got a copy of the audit, correct, Ann?
Yes, correct. It was added as an attachment to the resolution.
Okay. So we did have a clean audit. Like I said, revenues were similar from 2002-3 to 2002-2. We had revenues of about $32 million, mostly rental income revenues. The net income was lower. It went from $3.8 million gain to $187,000 gain. The $187,000 gain is more normalized for CDA operations. The last year we had some one-time event, extraordinary events, due to some of the development that's ongoing and that's happening right now. And we had the Monticello apartments that were sold that caused extraordinary gain. So anyway, $187,000, we're in the profit, which is good. The net position on the balance sheet is very strong. The assets for CDA are about $59 million. The market value of those assets, most of which is real estate, apartments, land, et cetera, is probably much higher than the $59 million. And we've hired some consultants as part of the Triangle redevelopment to look at really what's the value of all of the assets, the potential development value of any of the real estate assets that we own. So Matt talked about that. We have liabilities of $13 million, which is low. We have cash of $10 million, which is very strong. So I want to thank, and as Ann said at the meeting, which is true, we've got two major projects going on right now, right? We got the Triangle, we're building a couple thousand units there, and we've got the Badger, project, off Park Street, that's going to be building a couple thousand units there. So we're going to have some fluctuations going forward, as that development happens, to our financial statements. And Ann talked about that. And we have to kind of understand that's going on. I want to thank Ann and thank the rest of the staff that contributed to helping us develop a clean audit. We don't want to have any problems in that area. So that's all I have. Greg and Isidore, do you have anything to add?
I guess the only comment I would make, it's nice to have consecutive years, year over year, of having clean audits. It's reassuring to all of the commissioners, residents, and the public to know that we are running things properly.
Thank you. Isidore, you got anything to add? Or
no, I thought it was great having a clean audit, and I think staff did the audit person did a good job of explaining, the details of it. So I was very pleased.
Yeah. Ann, do you have anything to add?
No, you've done wonderful. Thank you.
Okay. So I guess, Claude, we've got a resolution to approve. If there's any questions, are there any questions from other commissioners?
Any questions? If not, as a very thorough report, I really appreciate your work on this, Mary, and the rest of the people on the subcommittee. I will take a motion for the resolution 4623.
I move approve.
Commissioner Gray, second.
It's been moved and seconded that resolution 4623 be approved, and that we'll consider this a unanimous vote unless there are any objection. And none, motion approved. Thank you very much, and great job on that, staff. And at this time, we have a presentation, correct, Lisa?
Next on the agenda is a presentation of the City of Madison 2025 budget briefing.
Hi there. My name is Christy Bonnell. I'm the deputy mayor for the City of Madison. And I understood that the CDA, along with actually many committees, have had some questions about what they're hearing about the City of Madison budget process. And I have a slide deck. I have kind of a comprehensive slide deck, so I might breeze through some of it for the sake of the CDA, but it is attached to your agenda in case you wanted to look at any of it in more detail. Let's see, do I share my screen?
Christy, you should be able to share your screen.
Okay, let me do that. Okay, you can see this slide deck?
Yeah.
Great. One thing I want to say from the get-go is, yes, the city is having budget challenges. Those are very specifically related to our general fund in the operating budget. It's not related to our capital budget. It's not related to CDA funding sources. So its influence on the CDA would probably be more related to community interests that the CDA cares about, like other sources related to housing and community services that are reliant on the general fund. It doesn't specifically affect the CDA budget, the capital or operating budget. So I want to make that clear. And that's part of the reason that I'm planning to breeze through the slides a little bit, but you are all people who are very involved in city business. And I think some level of understanding of the situation makes sense to share. So I'll give a little bit of information here. One, I guess just to start us off, one of the things that's happening is that we are growing fast. This is not a bad thing, but this is shows we are doing well economically. We have a high quality of life. People want to live here. That's not a bad thing. The challenge is that you need to scale your services as you grow, right? You can only add so many new garbage bins to be picked up before you need to add new garbage collection workers and trucks, right? And ambulance drivers and everything. So that all makes sense. The challenge is that the revenues that we can utilize for that are not growing at a natural rate. They're growing at a rate that's confined by state policies. State policy sets how our revenues can grow, and they aren't set in a way that recognizes inflation. I have a couple more slides that'll explain that a little bit more. So one, let's talk about basic tax dollars that you might pay, that a typical person might pay. There are other sources of money. There are little fees here and there. There are different things, but let's talk about three big buckets: property tax, sales tax, and income tax. So in the state of Wisconsin, sales tax and income tax do not go to cities. They go to the state. And that's supposed to be shared back with cities through something they call shared revenue. And this shows how much money the City of Madison gets and what some other cities get back in terms of shared revenue. We get back $29 per person. You can see that the city average is $195.
Christy, sorry to interrupt. We're only seeing what appears to be maybe the intro slide.
Oh, strange. Okay, I'm going to unshare and pull up. I was trying to share a PDF. Oh, I see what happened here. Let me reshare. I was trying to share the PDF version because something wonky always happens when you're trying to show PowerPoint and you suddenly can't see the people you're talking to anymore. But so you can see this, and let me go through. Can you see these slides advancing now?
Yes.
Yeah, we can. Okay.
So this is going back to what I was saying. Sales tax and income tax. When sales tax and income tax are spent or earned in Madison, they go to the state. The state shares them back with cities through a formula. We get $29 per person. The average city in Wisconsin gets $195 per person. There's a formula that the state's created to figure out who gets what. And this is what Madison gets. This is one major part of what's happening with our budget is that our proportion of that shared revenue is low. Now, if we got the city average of 195, we would have $55 million more in our budget. That's more than double what we're seeking in a referendum this year. So this is not insignificant. And what it amounts to really is that for every, another way to say the same thing is that for every dollar we pay to the state from those sources, we get 18 cents back. And that's 18 cents back to our geography, not just the city. That's to city government, that's to our school district, that's to this geographic portion of the county. So that is one of our problems. So that's sales and income tax and how it's shared back with us. Now, this number once upon a time was higher. It was the early 2000s where they kind of adjusted the formula. And what it meant was that cities had to become more and more reliant on their property taxes, because that is the revenue source we get. We get property tax. As cities became more reliant on it and kept raising it, in the Scott Walker years, they changed that formula to put limits on what we could raise it to. So what they did was they essentially said, no, we don't like how much you're raising the property tax. We're going to limit how much you can raise it. And that means that what they did is they put in place something called, it's a formula, how much we can raise it is based on net new construction. It's a way of thinking about how your city is growing. And that makes sense. So if you grow by 20%, you have more services, you should be able to grow your services by that much. The challenge is that that doesn't account for inflation. And that's really the crux of where we run into challenges. So you can see this has been in place for a long time. The blue line on the top here shows if we were able to accommodate for population growth and inflation, what our revenues would be. But the orange line on the bottom is what we've been allowed to have, essentially. So it's one thing to go 1 year without accounting for inflation, but when you go for 14 years without accounting for inflation, you start seeing a huge gap. Wages are not what they were in 2011. Healthcare doesn't cost what it costs. Services don't cost what they cost. And yet we're not really able to recoup any of that. So that's why we call it a structural deficit, is that it's structurally built in that every year our cost to continue services goes up at a rate higher than the revenues to perform those services. And that's what's coming to a head right now. This is just another way of saying, you know, what have we been doing about that? And essentially we've been doing more with less. We've kind of done the math of how many city employees would we have if we were able to keep up with that growth, and we would have about 217 more than we do. So we've been trying to stretch. That's one thing we've been trying to do. This is a highly, highly detailed table that lists everything we've done every year to try to close the gap, because There's been a gap every year. And you don't need to read the detail. It just means sometimes we've found fees we could create. Sometimes we've put more on our workers in terms of their share of benefits. We've done all kinds of things. We've cut services, we've stretched. And we are really kind of coming to a head where we can't really stretch anymore. Why? Why? In part was COVID made it worse. They made our revenue hits worse. And on top of that, the funding from this from the federal government to cover that COVID loss is coming to an end. And frankly, we've done everything we can do. So this is essentially where we're at now in terms of coming for a referendum. I have a couple slides here, again, very detailed. There's kind of what's our five-year plan with a referendum, without a referendum. Essentially, what you see here is the light blue is a $22 million referendum. And because costs go up every year, like I said, more than revenues, we still have to find new ways to cover the gap every year. So 2025, we just basically would have a referendum and a little bit of gray and efficiencies. The next year, we need to start using a little bit of our fund balance in green. That's our rainy day fund. We can use a little, not a lot. You got to keep that at 15% of your total budget. You all just talked about various financial reports. You're well steeped in that. And then we would have to come up with new special charges. So like right now, we have a resource recovery charge and urban forestry charge. We would have to start looking more deeply at revenue. But what this really is saying is we have a five-year plan to start working with the state or to continue working with the state to get a better deal. We have a changing state legislature. We have, new maps. So over the course of elections, we'll be seeing a changing state legislature. We also have 80 cities going to referendum. So I think they're hearing the message loud and clear that cities aren't hoping. And we're hoping between those two things, there'll be room and opportunity to continue a conversation to for them to recognize that this is not working for any cities in this state. I think just locally here, in addition to us, Monona, Maple Bluff, Fitchburg are all going. I think Middleton went a couple of years ago. Now, that's the with referendum scenario. Without a referendum, it looks honestly pretty ugly. Those new charges I talked about would be coming in sooner and they'd be larger. The fund balance, we still have to use just a little, but we run out of what we have to play with a little bit sooner. And then you see this orange come in, which is what we would have to start cutting. And I'm going to run through a quick list of the things on the plate to be cut. And so the mayor this year in the budget, she asked all departments to put forward 5% cuts. If you had to cut 5% in your budget, what would you offer up? And this year, if there's no referendum, she has to take a quarter of those cuts. But I guess one thing to point out is in these later years, you see this kind of clear or the unaddressed gap, the what's outlined in red there. Those would all be additional cuts we'd have to find. So in other words, within 5 years, she'd have to take all of these cuts. And it's, like I said, we've been stretching for years. So the easy stuff is all gone. The easy stuff has been done. This is changing what we do as a city. This is changing levels of service. So for example, rainy day funds. This is a smattering across the city, but to highlight a few, we've got fewer code enforcement officers and housing inspectors. We've got fewer poll workers for our elections. We would cut youth restorative justice. We would cut outreach for people experiencing homelessness. We would cut summer meals, community gardens. We cut our CARES program, fire service, a fire engine company, sustainability staffing would shift, library programs, parks, programming, beach cleaning. I mean, things that seem pretty fundamental. I think you kind of get the picture here that it's not easy stuff. You a lot related to police outreach, police patrol, traffic patrol enforcement, substance, safe community, substance use and injury prevention, violence prevention, street repair, Metro Nights service, crossing guards, breast collection. None of these, again, I'll say again, none of these are CEDA programs, but I think they're the types of thing, access community health, I think they're the types of things that CDA residents may care about. I think they're things related to general housing programming in the city. So there's kind of a relationship there, at least topically. These are, like I said, nobody wants to do this. The departments didn't want to put them forward. The mayor doesn't want to put them in a budget. So it's not a situation we want to be in. And what we're really hoping is that that voters will see to pass a referendum to essentially give us that lead time to start working with the state to get a better revenue deal for all cities in Wisconsin, not just us. This is what a referendum question on a ballot would look like. You don't really need to read it. Like I said, it's in your notes if you're interested, but the language is pretty set by the state. It's not something you can really play with. And this is what it would mean. It would give us that $22 million in revenue. Essentially, the average home in Madison is $457,000. That's $19 a month. So if your home is $230,000, it's about $10,950 a month. It's a little more complicated for renters because they don't directly pay property taxes, but there's some way, you know, their landlord is collecting enough money to cover their costs. So it hits them one way or another. And our estimates there are it's probably about $7 a month for the average renter. So this is essentially what's going forward, and essentially a timeline. We're putting the mayor's budget that proposes this will be out on October 8th. And then ultimately election day is November 5th. And depending on that outcome, referendum or not, the city council will have to adopt the budget either with or without their cuts. Depending on that outcome. So that is what I had, and I appreciate you giving me the time. I'm happy to answer any questions if folks have them.
Thank you for your presentation. Are there any questions or comments from the commissioners?
Alder Evers has his hand raised.
Go ahead, Alder Evers.
Thank you, Christy. Looking on the agenda, I actually don't see anything listed in Legistar. I don't see your deck or your presentation, so maybe we can get that posted.
Absolutely, yes.
Secondly, there have been some editorials that have suggested that, you know, things like Goodman Pool are being used as a pawn, or that any of these recommended cuts that agencies and their agency requests each department put up were somehow or another being specifically targeted as to pressure people. Isn't it more accurate to say that every year departments and agencies put forth an agency request, and that this year the agency requests were to include 5% cuts, and that the mayor's executive budget then, in fact, there will be two executive budgets put forth, one predicated and based on the idea that the referendum passes, the second on the idea that it doesn't pass, and that none of those recommendations are automatic. They will each be decided upon by the mayor to put into those executive budgets. And even at that point, they're not automatic because council has to effectively ratify the executive budget. The council has the final say. So I just want to address that misinformation that keeps putting out there that somehow there are threats. These aren't threats. It's just having to do good budgeting with the idea that our expenses now exceed our revenue, and that if the referendum doesn't pass, cuts will have to take place. We learned last night that those cuts, should the referendum not pass, will mean laying off some of our residents, and because of seniority situations, might fall disproportionately upon people of color, because while we've tried to expand diversity in our city employment, it's an effort that's incomplete and in process, but there are costs, there are real human costs to the referendum not passing, but so far nothing is written in stone. Not anything yet is written in stone. Is that not correct?
That is absolutely correct. So the mayor asked everybody for, if you had to cut 5%, what would you put forward? And in total, those add up to 22, 23 million in cuts. This year, she will have to develop a budget, one budget with a referendum passing without those cuts, and one budget with no referendum passing that would include 6 million of those cuts. Now, she can choose whatever 6 million she wants, and frankly, she doesn't have to take the agency recommendations of what they put forward, but it's certainly the most logical place to start. No, nothing that's on that list is automatically included, but I also will say that, so I've worked here 5 years. This has been a problem for much longer than that. And every single year we ask people for cuts. And I think anybody who's worked with the city long enough can see that people are stretched thin. They are strapped. And I think for a long time, we've been doing things that are like, well, maybe we'll just cut this vacant position. Maybe we'll just, they're trying to spread the same amount of work or more work around, like the same amount of work around fewer people or more work around, no more people. This year is the year where we said, please don't look at it like that. Please don't try to find a way that you can continue to do that, because we can see that it's no longer working. We have to start deciding what services we no longer provide. So you see things like no brush service, like cutting brush collection, or cutting, evening at hours of Metro or something. It can no longer be, let's try to do the same amount of work with fewer people doing it and everybody holding more. We've seen that stretched. And so we did ask for cuts to services. It has to be something that is a level of service reduction. We do something less than we used to, or we no longer do something we used to do. And that's probably why you see more that is related to closing libraries on Sundays, or you mentioned the Goodman Pool, but that was really, if you were to hear the parks director explain how he gets to 5%, he has to look at big things, and because it's a big budget. And so, yes, you're correct. None of it, because it's out there, means that it will be taken, but you do see a lot of things that are cuts to level of service, and that's because we can't just keep doing more with less. We've done that as much as we can.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Strickland. Thank you. We're next. Go ahead.
Christy, thanks for the presentation. My question is broad brush. We see as just individual taxpayers, we see thousands of apartments being built downtown off State Street and in the area, in this whole city. We see Exact Sciences building a brand new building and growing. So my question is, where has that money gone? I mean, there's a lot of growth and property tax, additional property taxes is being paid by the growth from both the corporate side and real estate development. It seems that should help with some of these budget deficits.
Doesn't it? I agree with you. It should. But I'm going to go back to a slide. That's not that's not able to get captured by the formula that we work under. So we are essentially, well, actually, in a way it is. So let me say this a different way.
I mean, yeah, that's the property tax side of it. I understand the problems with the state, but I'm just talking about what we have control of, which is the property tax, existing property tax levies.
Right. So what we're allowed to collect is essentially two ways to answer this question. I guess I'll do both just to make sure it's clear. One, we don't, what we get to change every year is the total amount we collect. So you have a total dollar amount you collect, and then you divvy it out amongst all the properties on the tax rolls. So it's the total that that is controlled, and it's the total that affects our budget. How it's divvied out on the tax rolls changes, right? So if you have four houses on the tax rolls that are worth $500,000, they each pay 25% of your total, whatever your total is. If they all go up in value and they're all worth $600,000, they all still pay 25%. You know what I mean? So like the more the value goes up, you're still just comparing your percentage of the total base accord compared to every other property in the city. It's the total that affects our budget. And the total is recognizing net new construction. And that is part of the equation for sure. That's a proxy for how much we've grown. And that's not insignificant, but it's part of how our costs grow. The other part is just that costs grow. There's inflation. Like I said, things don't cost what they cost in 2011. We pay people more, our healthcare costs more, our contracts cost more, our services cost more, and none of that is in the calculation. So if everything held constant at what it cost in 2011, net new construction as a formula might work okay. But as it is, I think basically what it comes down to is inflation's gone up like 3-4% a year is our 20-year average. And what we can raise the revenue at is somewhere between 1-2% a year. The net new construction formula tends to leave us at 1-2% a year, and inflation is higher than that.
If I might just jump in, prior to 2011, we also, in addition to net new construction, we are allowed a factor that accounted for inflation. But since right. Scott Walker, it's only net new construction. Right. And it's simply, Christie's right, that allows for about a 1-2% increase in revenue a year. It's simply not sufficient. And the amount of the formula of revenue increase calculated with net new construction is surprisingly low. It's not particularly dramatic.
Thank you. Commissioner Reed, go ahead. Then Alder Knox, go ahead, Commissioner Reed.
I guess my question is, there's been a lot of talk about why don't you tap into the rainy day fund? And I believe there's a provision that requires you to have at least 15% set aside. So if you could just maybe address that issue. And then the other thing I'll say is I worked for Moody's as the rating agency for 9 years. And while I worked in commercial mortgage-backed securities, I'm very familiar with how rating agencies view things. And if you don't have a plan in place and you're basically dragging along with a contingency plan that you're coming up with every single year, they do not look favorably on that. They want to know that there's consistency, that they're not going to be surprises along the way. So I just want to toss that in as well. And mm-hmm. I think what's being proposed does provide some consistency for the near term, at least. But if you could just talk about the rainy day fund and what requirements are around that.
Sure. So this is one of those slides that I breezed past, but maybe I shouldn't have. So this dark purple line in the middle is that 15% rate. And you can see that this goes from 1995 to present, and that red dotted line at the end is in the future, our future projections. Sometimes we're above, sometimes we're below. We found ourselves above even more than we expected to this year because with broader economic factors, right? Like rates have increased, and that has turned into us getting a better return on some of our investments, which is good. So right now we have more, but we are expecting to use some of that in these slides. So the fund balance green, that's our rainy day fund. And we are expecting to, this is in the pro, with a referendum passing, we would expect to use that little bit of extra we have. And you see here, it says rainy, the 25 million additional we have in the rainy day fund would be expended in 2030. And without a referendum, that goes a little faster and it's expended in 2029. So we try to stay at that 15%, and just as part of good fiscal management. We've done well so far. We have a AAA credit rating. It's the highest credit rating you can get. It means we can borrow money at extremely low rates, so it saves us and property taxpayers money in the long run. And we're trying to remain there. I don't know if our, I'm not sure our 5 year, I mean, we have gone to a 5 year budgeting plan, and that's what the two options you saw on the prior page were, but yeah, that's essentially how we're planning.
So Christy, what is the total amount of the rainy day fund that you can tap?
I don't know if I have that. I think where we are planning, we see a $25 million, what's the word? It doesn't seem like surplus, but it seems like we could spend $25 million and remain over that 15%. But spending it all in 1 year is not something we think would be wise, because then it's gone. It's one-time money. And we talked about this, being a structural gap, right? So then the next year, you'd have the whole gap. You'd have the gap that was plugged by the rainy day fund last year that is no longer available to plug it, plus the extra added on for the next year. So okay. You would just have a bigger hole and you'd have no source to plug it. So using it all at once is not something we think is wise, but using it little by little over years is something that we think we can do in order until we reach that 15%.
Okay, does that answer your question, Greg?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, Commissioner Knox, go ahead.
Thank you. I really appreciate the presentation. I guess I just have more comments, and perhaps Deputy, you can react to some of my comments. I just want to say, you know, I felt good that the mayor offered her scenario, an opposite scenario. And from a lot of our discussions at the council meetings, there probably are some other ones that exist as well. So I guess from my perspective, I guess I'm one of those people that think that the referendum option is an easier way out. I think it locks us into the referendum for that 5 year period. And then we really aren't sure where we will be at the end of that period. And I'm not sure what procedures we can use to even, you know, stop or end the referendum if the fiscal circumstances would change. You know, ultimately, the voters will make that decision. Whatever they decide, they expect us to review every line item in each department budget to ensure that we're actually prioritizing on essential services and the resources we need to provide those things adequately. Some people talked about maybe a one-time referendum where we can have more appropriately allow for time to focus on what efforts we can do to, one option is advocate to to the state for relief and maybe a more pragmatic approach to reducing the budget. We know that Milwaukee did that and they were able to get some relief. And I think that it's important for the city to have lobbyists focused on continuing those kind of conversations to see if eventually there could be some relief coming from the state, especially with some of the changes that are occurring. But I also think we need to consider the fact that in either scenario, we have to utilize the contingency fund, which actually increased in revenue in 2024. And previously, it was the city who decided to decide how to use those those COVID funds, splitting part of it on budget infrastructure things, and then also using half of it to support nonprofit agencies. That was their choice to do, but now those funds no longer exist. So we have to keep in, and we also need to keep in mind that we have a significant MMSD referendum coming too. Mm-hmm. I talked to a lot of the residents. We know that interest rates are up, but they seem to be going back down. We know that gas is up, food is up, all our costs are up. And then we want to add a referendum on top of another larger governmental referendum. You know, some people think maybe this is the year we need to figure out how to balance the budget and give some the taxpayers some relief. But in any case, I think it's time that we look at doing what we all do, tighten our budgets and prioritize based on those essential services. There are many ways to balance the budget. We certainly may have to do that ultimately anyway if the citizens decide not to support the referendum. And I think we need to consider things like consolidation of services. You know, if the revenues increased at the end of 2023, how do we know in the next 5 years they won't continue to increase, even though we have a projection that they will go down? We just don't know what the future holds. It may be better, in my mind, to budget, you know, more slowly than to gamble on a five-year plan that we could actually have a worse scenario at the end of that. So I think, you know, one way or another, the citizens will decide, but there are more ways to look at this than just this way. So I just wanted to make those comments. I know that most of the Common Council apparently doesn't agree with me, but I think there are a lot of citizens that really would prefer a more, you know, conservative approach to this budget.
Okay, thank you, Alder Knox. Alder Tech, you still had your hand up?
Yeah. Well, yes, Alder Knox did vote against the referendum, and so I'm going to offer my own comments as a counterpoint. If the referendum passes, we do not need to use the full taxing authority. It simply increases our taxing authority. And if we're able to find other sources of revenue, including through lobbying state government, and get a sales tax passed, or get a regional transit authority passed, or get an increased portion of the municipal service charges come in our way, or get a different calculation on how the levy limit is determined, then we do not need to use the full taxing authority. There are challenges, though, with this notion that we could take a greater portion of the unassigned balance and pay down the it's conceivably possible, folks, that we could use all the unassigned balance, i.e. the rainy day fund, and pay it off this $22 million this year. Next year, that same our deficit is anticipated to be $28 million there. And so if our efforts fail in terms of being able to lobby with the state, and by the way, Robin Voss has made it very clear that he thinks Madison's situation is quite different from Milwaukee's. Milwaukee was facing bankruptcy due to unfunded retirement accounts and pension accounts. Their deficit was over $200 million, not $22 million. So, and they came with an essentially a lot of parameters that were really confining. It was a deal that Milwaukee had little choice but to take. But if we go all in, as former Mayor Soglin has suggested, and use the rainy day fund or the unassigned balance and pay it all down this year, we'll be facing a $28 million deficit next year. And then the earliest we'd be able to go to referendum would be in April of 2026 during the spring election then, or more likely in fall of 2026 during the gubernatorial election. At that time, the cuts that we would have to make would be much more severe. And I would suggest alders were given an opportunity to respond to the mayor as to what cuts they recommend. And I hope that Alder Knox took the time to share with the mayor, as I did, his recommended cuts, because it's not a lighthearted thing to come up with $22 million worth of cuts over a five-year period. Or however much it's going to be. And it's incumbent upon alders to recommend those cuts now, because cuts in services will be costly. And we can't just sit back and say, well, we think this would be a better way to go, to live within our means. We haven't hired a new garbage worker since 2007. If we had kept pace with our employees with population growth, we'd have 217 more employees on the city payroll. We are currently doing more with less, and we're burning out our employees. They're experiencing burnout. So we will have to reduce the amount of services, and we will have to lay off some employees if the referendum doesn't pass. It's not a matter of the city not having lived within its means. It's a matter of the state essentially putting forth what are widely regarded as punitive measures. They believe that we should cut expenses. They believe that the $3.5 million rainy day fund and surplus that the state has, that the governor wants to share with cities. Instead, the Republican legislature wants that tax cuts to all citizens throughout the state. The governor is advocating on the behalf of cities, but Robin Voss is not going to help out Madison. He's not going to help out other cities. It's against the Republican philosophy. So if we move forward in this path, it will mean cuts in services and it will mean layoffs. And I would hope those who advocate that we go in that direction have some idea of how that should play out.
Thank you. Any other comments? Commissioner Gray, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman. Hey, I just want to thank the Deputy Mayor, obviously, for the presentation, as well as the other information. I missed some of the information because obviously something happened on my computer, but also want to thank the commissioners for chiming in as well. So I guess the only question I have with all this information, I know that oftentimes I'm looking at television and I'm seeing that we're having presidents come to Wisconsin. I'm seeing prospective presidential candidates come to Wisconsin. And I'm just wondering, are we not getting any assistance from the federal government in terms of some of the resources that we need here in Madison? And I guess the other question that I would have for the Deputy Mayor is, when is the election coming up so I could actually start thinking about sharing some of this information with my friends, family members, and also individuals that I live with about the significance of really voting on these referendums that's being proposed?
Sure, thank you. So for your second question, Election Day is November 5th. And when I share the link to the PowerPoint slide, we have other kind of one pagers and basic things that are shareable as well. And I can put a link there on a website and I can add that link. I should probably just add a slide that has links, but On the money that we get from the federal government, we usually, yes, we are really, really aggressive about applying for federal grants and state grants. And we get a lot of them. I think I just had this number. I think since 2020, we've got it was $563 million in grants, I think. So we get quite a bit. But there's a, so we have two different basic budgets, our operating budget and our capital budget. The capital budget is projects. And usually grant money goes to projects. The operating budget is basically your staffing and everyday services. So like just the people who show up to work at the library every day, the people who show up to run the ambulance every day, et cetera. The grants don't cover kind of those standard general operating costs. They tend to cover projects in the capital budget. Capital budget is essentially, it's a different budget. It's got different funding sources, got different restrictions. It does not have a financial problem because it's not developed under these kind of, you know, policy-driven restrictions that that cities have to deal with in their operating budgets. So, you know, whether it's building a road or building a building or buying vehicles or what have you, those are all considered our capital investments, and we can get grant funding to cover that so that we don't have to bond for it or use other revenue sources for it. But essentially, when you have money in the capital budget, you can't just move it to the operating budget. You can't move it over to cover that. So it hasn't been helping with the operating budget.
Thank you.
Christy, I think my comments is that whatever you have in the mix of the list, I want to make sure that you give or do consideration to the people who are most vulnerable and who don't have a lot of what I consider to be advocacy. They're on the margins. And so services are an important part of that. So I would like to think that you're looking at impact and whatever we can do to mitigate that, I would encourage that to be consideration. I didn't look at your whole bucket list of everything, but the side of the people who are going to be most impacted, especially people who are poor or people of color, that is one of my areas of concern. So any other questions or comments?
We have Alder Knox and Alder Evers both have their hands raised.
You guys, you guys are good?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay. Alder Tack, you had any?
Yeah, just real quick to what you're saying, Chairman Gilmore, is that there are several of the nonprofits that I'm familiar with, like Justine and Bayview Foundation and Boys and Girls Club, who receive funds from the city's Community Services Fund and Community Development Division, are concerned about this. Now, while CDA is not facing any cuts in this next year, and a lot of the funds for CDA come from the federal government, so it would not be impacted by the budget challenges the city is facing. Bayview would be facing potential cuts. So would many other nonprofits in our city that provide services to the poor and to vulnerable residents in our community. So that is a concern. I know many of the churches are beginning to organize on behalf of the referendum. And while churches are often very generous in their commitment and their services to the least among us, they are concerned that some of the funds that the city has provided through the various grants that we offer through the Community Development Division would not be available in the future. And so they would like to see these partnerships continue. But if the referendum doesn't pass, it'll be increasingly difficult for those funds to be made available.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate that. Auto Tech, Auto Knox, did you have any other comments before
we proceed? Yeah. I just want to say, look, you know, everybody understands the importance of providing not only essential services, but very needed services to a lot of vulnerable populations. But we also haven't been someone who's worked in government for over 36 years, have experienced many budgets where we have budgets of plenty, and then we have smaller budgets. And most of us who's been in government management, like you understand, Claudius, we build on those bases. We really should be looking at each of those budgets and making some determinations on what some of those services are essential, who would they impact, and correct, then maybe some are not. So just like your home budget, where you make tough decisions about what you would like, when in some years you can get that little extra whatever that you want, and then other years that you can't. It's the same way here. You know, some of these things that these individual budgets have put out, I mean, I'm just going to use an extreme example. Parks puts the pool out there, and we know there are that some philanthropy in our community contributed significantly for that pool to be there in a particular neighborhood, so that poor kids who don't have access to those services could avail themselves of that. But right, is that the option you use as opposed to golf courses where more affluent people go and will pay for those to go to those golf courses, you know, or right, some other things? We really have to look at not just putting things that are easy to put out on the block to make that 5%. We have to be real and evaluate those things and think hard and long about what are those services that we really need to maintain, right, versus the others. So my only point of making my comments is that there are different perspectives on this budget, on this referendum, and we know ultimately it's all going to impact people's pocketbooks, and we need to just make sure that we're all, I respect all the tag, I respect all of the nonprofits and the city employees who come, but you know what? I've been in environments as a government employee where we've taken furloughs and we've done certain things to lessen the, you know, the impact. And that's true. I came in state government when we got a 0% increase. Claude, you kind of can be familiar with that. And that was reality back then. Right. But we know things have changed. People are paying more for those benefits now than we used to pay little, nothing for those benefits. So we got to consider all of those things and how it's impacting individuals. So I don't want people to get to thinking that there's some people out here who are being harsh, but no, they're being harshly impacted, you know, in their pocketbooks.
Yeah, and I think I agree with you. And I've been an executive for over 30 years. I've seen all of that and had to make those tough decisions. I do hope that on a macro sense if there are some changes in the legislature and that we were able to get shared revenue to be a bit more balanced, that would be certainly helpful. But again, you know, we are where we are. We have to work through this. So Christy, we thank you for sharing this information. Hopefully we'll hear more down the road here as we go forward. And best of luck.
All right, thank you.
So at this time, we appreciate that. We're going to move to one other item we have on the agenda before we close, and that is the report on the Housing Authority operations from Larry.
All right. So I'm going to share my screen. I'm going to reverse the order that I normally go in. So we should be seeing here momentarily the aged rent receivables report. So over last month, we've seen a slight downtick in total delinquency amount owed, as well as the delinquency rate has notched down a percent or so So holding pretty steady at what we saw last month. As I reported last month, we do have a number of households that we are working with and have issued the kind of the next steps in what would be the larger eviction process. So I will keep you updated as much as I can, since those are sensitive conversations and sensitive processes. But just wanted to recognize that we are now continuing to work with the city attorney's office on, I believe the last number I gave at the last board meeting was 9 households. So slight changes here in this report, but nothing overly dramatic to report on for this report. I do want to highlight some positive news on our housing choice voucher utilization report. You'll see numbers for August that the number of vouchers that we are issuing is the most that we have since COVID. So the number of vouchers that we have out in people's hands in units is 1,864 for the main HCV program. And you'll continue to see the utilization of the budget amount kind of hovering right around 120%. So we are continuing to work with HUD on helping us make sure that we have enough funds in our reserves to cover those costs. As you go down the sheet, you'll see the other programs. Sorry, I have to keep moving something here. The project-based vouchers at 65% utilized. Our mainstream program is 92%, and our emergency housing voucher program, as I've been alluding to over the last number of months, we were 106, 104%. We are now back under that threshold of 100% for that program. So the money that we spent kind of a little bit heavier earlier in the year, as we don't spend that full amount on the back end, it should even out pretty quickly. And then for the other really good news for the occupancy of our public housing units, I know I like to get ahead of myself on this report and report actually very current numbers. We met with HUD today, and although this report's through July, our overall public housing portfolio is at 95.5% occupied. So hitting the HUD goal that is listed at the top for our public housing portfolio, which again is a number that we haven't seen since prior to COVID. So incredible work by our admissions and eligibility teams in pulling names for our voucher program, as well as pulling people off waiting lists for public housing. And then for the Section 8 program, for staff getting those vouchers into people's hands, briefing them, and getting them out on the street to lease up. And then at our public housing sites, kudos to site managers for showing units. Kudos to maintenance staff for getting units turned when people vacate. It's been a very, very all hands on deck and intense process over the last number of months for both programs. And I think we're seeing the benefits of all of the additional staff work. Again, these reports are a few months behind, so I am getting ahead of myself, but you'll continue to see these numbers go up here on this occupancy report. Any questions?
Thank you for that report. Are there any questions from the commissioners? Go ahead, Commissioner Strickland.
Yeah, quick question. Larry, does that 95% occupancy affect the PFAS score, which we're our goal of trying to become a high performer with HUD?
Yeah, so the threshold that you see here, this 98.5, the state HUD office sets a higher goal than kind of HUD overall. So this is a target that they continue to push us to hit, which is above what the national HUD expectations are. But yeah, it does impact the scoring criteria for kind of those different scores that combine to then become what we're shooting for as a high performer. Absolutely. I should mention that Across the country, public housing occupancy is under 95%. So just as a comparison to around the country.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Go ahead, Commissioner Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Larry, thanks for, again, all the hard work on these reports and keeping us updated. And so one of the things that as I look at the age rent receivable summary, as I look at the East AMP and I look at the West, are you guys specifically like working with those two particular sites in terms of some of the issues that have taken place with the delinquent payments, or is that you're kind of just working with all the different AMPs together, or are you kind of singling out the ones that really need more attention? Can you share any information on that particular process?
Yeah, so each site, each AMP has staff that are specifically, each site has staff that do this work specific to that site. So it's not kind of a portfolio-wide, where is the need? Okay, let's push staff in that direction to go to that site to work with residents. Across all of our sites, we have staff that are working with residents on getting caught up. I think, as I mentioned at our last meeting, if you kind of unpack some of these numbers, certainly at West and at Parkside, we do have, I think there's three households that account for the vast majority of those balances.
Yeah.
And I think that's really highlighted in these percentages. So for example, the delinquency rate at West is 12%, but I'm sorry, the number of households is 12%, but the rate is 25%. So once we kind of get that one or two households kind of through this process, you'll see the number of households not drop necessarily a lot because it's only one or two, but you'll see this percentage get cut in half. The same with Parkside. I believe there's one or two households that are accounting for the vast majority of this delinquent amount. And just based on the size of Caravis, right, you just have a number, it's such a small property that it really, when you have one unit that owes a lot, it throws the delinquency rate way off. And that's why I think it's important to continue to put the household, number of households that are behind, because to me that the number of households behind are really more of a measure of how much continued work our staff has. Because if you help one household get caught up, that's one household, but that balance could be $200 or that balance could be $5,000. So really the household percentage is to me more of like a measure of how much work staff has to do. The delinquency amount kind of varies because we're putting in the same amount of energy for someone who's $500 behind, which is a lot of energy, potentially, with someone who's 5,000 behind. And again, we're not reflecting that we're putting in less energy on 500. It's that we're putting a lot of energy in on 500 and 5,000. So it gets kind of buried that we have, I think, four or five households across all of our sites that are running at very high delinquency amounts. And once we continue to work through the process, again, whether it's getting it corrected or through the eviction process, you'll see those numbers drop drastically on the rate side of it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Larry. Okay,
thank you. Pretty much that. Alder Knox, you had your hand up.
No, I'm sorry. It was left up. Sorry.
Okay. All right. Commissioner Strickland, did you have another question?
Sorry, no.
Oh, okay. Appreciate it, Larry. This is a very good report. And thank you for sharing that. And I know this is a lot of hard work, so give our appreciation to the staff, because I know it takes a lot to do this. At this time, are there any other items we have before we move to close? Appreciate everyone. It's a good meeting. At this time, Lisa, do we have anything else?
The next item is adjournment.
Yeah, motion for adjournment.
Commissioner Gray, second.
I can't motion. You guys go ahead.
Oh,
so moved.
Yeah, and it's a move and second that we are now in adjournment. So thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Don't forget to vote November 5th.
Gotcha.